Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Trip Planner by Expedia. You were made to have strong opinions about sand. We were made to help you and your friends find a place on the beach with a pool and a marina and a waterfall and a soaking tub. Expedia. Made to travel.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 24th of February, these are our main stories. Alexei Navalny's mother says Russian officials are threatening to bury his body in the Arctic prison where he was held if she doesn't agree to a secret funeral. Poland gets a $150 billion offer from the European Union. But will the cash actually arrive? And
I see from behind the gates that these emaciated women with children would come, and the bodies were so thin. They were desperate. I mean, they were just coming in streams.
A new BBC radio series remembers the Bengal famine, which killed 3 million people in India during World War II. Also in this podcast, the US says Israel's plans to build new homes in the occupied West Bank is inconsistent with international law. And why did a big star make such a big bang?
It's about 20 light years across. A teaspoon of this material weighs about as much as Everest.
It is a grim choice. Alexei Navalny's mother has apparently been told she must agree to a private funeral for her son without any mourners, or else the authorities will bury him in the Arctic prison where he died. Meanwhile, the Kremlin has continued to deny allegations that it was involved in Mr. Navalny's death. Reaction from the West, it says, has been hysterical. From Moscow, our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg.
According to a spokesperson for Alexei Navalny's family, a Russian investigator called Mr. Navalny's mother, Lyudmila, and delivered an ultimatum. Either she agree within 3 hours for her son to be laid to rest without a public funeral, or he would be buried in the remote penal colony, where he died a week ago. The spokesperson added that Lyudmila Navalny had refused to negotiate. Instead, she had demanded her son's body be handed over in accordance with Russian law, insisting that investigators were obliged to do so within 2 days of cause of death being established. Lyudmila Navalny said yesterday that she had been presented with and signed Alexei Navalny's medical death certificate. It reportedly claims that Russia's most prominent opposition leader died of natural causes. But his widow, Yulia, has accused Vladimir Putin of killing her husband. The Kremlin has described accusations that the president is responsible for Mr. Navalny's death obnoxious and unacceptable.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. This row comes just as Ukraine marks 2 years since the Russian invasion. Friday saw dozens of foreign ministers gathered at the United Nations headquarters to discuss a path for Ukraine. Some Western leaders urged allies not to tire in their support for Kyiv, just hours after the US President Joe Biden unveiled more sanctions aimed at damaging Moscow's ability to wage war.
Remember, the United States pulled together a coalition of more than 50 nations to support Ukraine. That's why I'm announcing more than 500 new sanctions in response. In response to Putin's brutal war of conquest, in response to Alexei Navalny's death.
President Biden. We're watching that session at the UN was our correspondent in New York, Neda Torfik, who sent this report.
Ukraine's allies were eager to show their unwavering support as peace remains a distant prospect. More than 50 foreign ministers and ambassadors, mainly from the West, gathered before the UN Security Council debate and flanked the Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba as he read out a joint statement. It condemned Russia's invasion as a flagrant violation of international law and urged countries not to provide weapons to Russia's military. What some have referred to as Ukraine fatigue has set in amongst nations of the global south. And multiple other global crises, including the war in Gaza, have diverted attention away from Moscow's invasion. Inside the chamber, Mr. Kuleba appealed for international solidarity.
Moscow hopes that the world will deplete its empathy towards Ukrainians if Ukrainians are killed every single day for too many days in a row. We shall not allow this to happen. We will rally the world behind our true cause even more. Russian terror only strengthens our resilience and commitment.
Russia's ambassador Vasily Nebenzia, along with its ally China, criticized NATO's expansion towards Russia's borders.
Western leaders fooled us during the years of the Cold War and want to continue to fool us now. They consider the rights of NATO to continue to expand as an absolute right and transforming any corner of the world into the area of responsibility of the alliance.
Due to Russia's veto power, the international body has been blocked from addressing the conflict. However, the UK and the US have imposed unilateral sanctions against Russia, the latest of which target the country's defense industry and financial sector.
Neda Torfik. There's nothing quite like sniffing around for a bit of spare cash and then having your pockets suddenly filled with gold. But that's pretty much what's happened to Poland, which has been offered about $150 billion worth of extra spending money by the European Union. The money was blocked when the previous Polish government of the Law and Justice Party was accused of politicising the law, which was deemed to be in breach of EU rules. But the new Prime Minister, Donald Tusk's administration, has laid out a plan to make the judiciary properly independent, a move that got the thumbs up from the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen.
We are impressed by your efforts and those of the Polish people to restore the rule of law as the backbone of your society. Together, we will protect the rule of law all over Europe.
Standing beside Ms. von der Leyen, the Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, made it pretty clear that as far as he was concerned, the only reason this money was coming Poland's way was because his government had come to power after the election last October.
We have it. This is a very important day. We have worked a lot together, especially Poles, on October the 15th, choosing democracy and the rule of law. This really is a mountain of money that we will use well and that we will also use to relieve everything that is currently causing such tension and anxiety.
Donald Tusk, I asked our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt, whether this was now a done deal.
Well, you'd have thought that from the gushing press conference there. Ursula von der Leyen and Donald Tusk come from the same European political grouping, the centre-right EPP. They also know each other well. But even so, he's only been in power for just over 2 months. So it's amazing how quick this has shifted. It was one of his main priorities to entirely reset relations with Brussels and restore the rule of law in Poland after 8 years of law and justice government. The difficulty is that there's this roadmap, but the problem is Donald Tusk doesn't control all the parts of government. So the president is a Law and Justice Party ally, Andrzej Duda, and it's possible that he could veto some of the measures that they plan to put into place. And also the Constitutional Court has a majority of pro-law and justice judges there, people that they appointed. So that's another potential stumbling block.
There were very pointed choices of words there by Ursula von der Leyen, talked about protecting the rule of law all over Europe. She's got a particular country in mind, hasn't she?
She certainly does. It's the other main transgressor as far as Brussels concerned, which is Hungary. But the situation with Hungary is very different. Viktor Orban was re-elected to a fourth term only last year, so he's very solidly in power there. So he has a different but related dispute on rule of law, and the EU Commission is withholding billions of dollars of funds still. It's released some in December when there was a council about Ukraine, but he is showing no signs of changing on that level.
Also interesting words used by Donald Tusk. He said Poland would use the money to relieve the things causing tension and anxiety. What did that mean?
Well, one of those is the farming dispute that's going on in Poland in terms of blockading the Ukrainian border because Polish farmers are upset, among other things, with cheap Ukrainian grain coming into Poland. But there are other issues too. So although money is going to go to farmers, there's also things about the green transition. So some of these funds will help Poland, which is very heavily dependent on fossil fuels, to ease workers' concerns in that sector.
Danny Eberhardt. It's not often the United States criticises Israel, perhaps a little more common than it was. But still, it says something that the Secretary of State has said that Israel's settlements in the West Bank are inconsistent with international law, which sounds like a roundabout way of saying they're illegal. Most countries already hold that view, but under the presidency of Donald Trump, it wasn't so in America. From Washington, here's our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken described Israeli settlement building in the occupied West Bank as inconsistent with international law. The statement brings the US back in line with most of the international community, which sees the transfer of any country's civilians to occupied territory as illegal under the Fourth Geneva Convention. It finally overturns a move made in 2019 by the Trump administration, which was welcomed by Israel when then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that Washington no longer viewed settlements as a breach of international law. Mr. Pompeo later became the first serving Secretary of State to make an official visit to a West Bank settlement where he has a brand of wine named after him. Mr. Blinken added that he was disappointed by Israel's announcement on Thursday of plans to build more than 2,000 new housing units in the West Bank. The country's government said it was doing that in response to a Palestinian gun attack close to a settlement which killed an Israeli man and left 10 wounded.
Tom Bateman. Once upon a time, in a galaxy not so far away, there was an explosion, one so big that by 1987, people here on Earth could see it with the naked eye. But despite being what you might call a high-vis cosmic event, nobody could work out what caused it. Until now, this latter-day Big Bang was, it seems, a star, effectively blowing itself to pieces. And not just any star, but a so-called blue giant, which has been given the catchy name SN1978A. What remained afterwards was something even more remarkable, a neutron star. That's an object so dense that a single teaspoon would weigh 10 million tons. Dr. Olivia Jones from the Royal Observatory in Edinburgh was one of those who uncovered the mystery. She told the BBC's Roland Pease why a single star's death had such extraordinary consequences.
Really massive stars, like supernova 1987A, or what it was beforehand, was about 20 times the mass of a sun. If you think of our sun as a tennis ball in size, the star that formed 87A was about as big as a London Eye. The pressure and density right in the centre of that star is phenomenal. So it creates this really, really compact core. A teaspoon of this material of a neutron star weighs about as much as Everest. And the fact that you can see it when it first exploded with the naked eye is unprecedented for such an object in another galaxy like this. We've been able to see how it evolves in real time, which in astronomy terms is extremely rare, just tracing the evolution of the death of a star. What you see initially is the actual explosion of the star itself right in the centre. Then we had a period of about 10 years where you couldn't actually see very much in the centre. You needed these new telescopes like Webb and JWST to see the mechanics of the explosion. And then key to this is what was left behind. And we've been searching for that holy grail. Has a neutron star formed or has a black hole been left behind? And the wonderful thing about the Webb telescope, you can see at high resolution both the ring, the outer debris of the star, and the right in the very centre where the explosion was. So what we see where the star was and where it exploded was argon and sulphur. And we know that these needed an awful lot of energy. And the only thing that could be doing this is a neutron star.
So this is basically an extraordinarily hot nuclear ember that's sitting in the middle.
Yes, right in the middle. And you can see this because supernova 1987A is about 20 light years across in total. And we can isolate the core where the explosion was from the rest of the debris in this nearby galaxy, which is, I think is fantastic.
Do you know how hot the surface of this star is? And is it just the intense heat, X-ray heat that's coming off that's causing all this radiation that you're seeing?
I hope you're ready for a very big number.
Go on.
The neutron star is over 1,000,000 degrees Celsius.
Scientist Olivia Jones talking to Roland Pease, and you can hear more of that interview on this week's Science in Action programme here on the BBC World Service. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
China has lasted two decades or so, really a hotspot for fossils of different time periods, including the one we're talking about today, the Triassic. Really astounding fossils are coming out of China.
The remarkable discovery of a 5-meter-long ancient aquatic creature known as the terrible-headed reptile. It's quite a fall from grace. 7 years ago, Sebastian Kurz was being feted as the youngest ever chancellor in Austria's history. Indeed, he was for a while the youngest head of state in the world. But Friday saw the former chancellor given an 8-month suspended prison sentence for perjury. This revolves around testimony he gave to a parliamentary committee. Mr. Kurz intends to appeal. He denies any wrongdoing, as Bethany Bell reports from Vienna.
Mr. Kurz was once hailed as a rising star among European conservatives before he left politics in 2021. But this ruling deals a blow to any chances he might have had of launching a political comeback. The court ruled that Mr. Kurz had given false statements to a parliamentary committee investigating corruption in 2020. In a separate case, Mr. Kurz is still under investigation for allegedly spending public money for favourable media coverage, something he denies. He's not been charged in that case.
Bethany Bell. When is a Muslim not a Muslim? That's a very contentious issue in Pakistan, where some denominations consider others not to be the real thing. One group that's been particularly shunned and has faced continued persecution is the Ahmadi sect. Their mosques have been bombed, congregations sprayed with automatic weapons, because Islamist militants regard the Ahmadi faith as blasphemous. But a recent court judgment has provoked protest, because the judge ruled that Ahmadis should be free to practice their faith. Our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etharajan told me more.
A man from the Ahmadi sect was accused of disseminating a forbidden text, that is Ahmadi text, because the Ahmadis are not considered as part of Islam mainstream Muslims by the hardliners. Now, when it went to the court after spending several months in jail, what the judge found was reading this script was made illegal only in 2021, but he was accused of reading this in 2019. And during that ruling, the Supreme Court Chief Justice Qazi Faiz Issa also made several comments about how to respect one's religion and what are the fundamental tenets of Islam. Now, Islamists in the country were angry, saying that he was accused of blasphemy because Ahmadis are not considered as Muslims by the hardliners. So releasing him from prison was strongly criticized by various groups, and that is why they were also showing their anger against the Chief Justice. The ruling came about 2 weeks ago, but it slowly started in a social media discussion. Now it has become a protest movement, thousands of people protesting in the city of Peshawar, and then several hardline groups expressing their anger against the Chief Justice and the system.
There have been previous cases in Pakistan where high-profile legal figures have made rulings or defended causes which others considered blasphemous. And those legal figures have ended up being murdered, so presumably the judges here ought to be rather nervous.
That's a concern for the legal community now, and that is why the Supreme Court had to issue a statement yesterday clarifying that it was not against Islam, it was not blasphemy, it was based on the rule of law.
But not everyone's going to believe that, are they?
And that is the discussion on social media was, you know, more stronger. Blasphemy is a very sensitive issue in Pakistan. And over the years, a number of people from this particular Ahmadi sect, they were attacked and they were killed on accusations of insulting Islam. Even though it is punishable by death, no one has been executed by law in Pakistan for blasphemous charges. But the angry Islamists can run into your house. There have been bomb blasts and gun attacks, people lynched to death. These things have happened. And this is what terrifies many people, especially when it comes to issues related to blasphemy.
Anbarasan Etharajan. 3 million, that's the number, thought to have died in the Bengal famine in the middle of the Second World War in British India. It's one of the largest losses of civilian life on the Allied side. Yet there's no memorial, no museum, not even a plaque anywhere in the world to those who died. Partha Mitta was a boy living in Calcutta at the time.
I see from behind the gates that these emaciated women with children would come, and the bodies, you know, were so thin. They were desperate. I mean, they were just coming in streams.
Do you remember what they were asking for?
Oh, yes. In Bengali, it's a ektupandema. Mother, give me a little bit of that watery bit of the rice.
They were not even asking for rice. They were asking for the dregs.
They can't, because they're so desperate. They thought that people wouldn't have the rice even to give them.
That 3 million figure for the number of deaths also gives a title to a new BBC radio series which pieces together the story of the Bengal famine through first-hand accounts. 3 million is produced by Cavita Puri. And Nick Robinson asked her first how the famine happened.
It's complex and hugely contested. But the context is the Second World War. Burma had fallen in early 1942 and the rice supply had ceased coming into Bengal. And it's kind of little known, but in Calcutta, there were hundreds of thousands of Allied soldiers stationed there going to and from the Asian front, and they all needed to be fed. And the colonial government was printing money to pay for all the wartime resources, and inflation was rife, and rice, the staple food, was kind of unaffordable for millions of people. And for those living in the Bengal Delta, their boats, their food had been taken away by the colonial authorities because they feared that there would be a Japanese invasion. They'd seen how they'd progressed across Southeast Asia, taking local resources. And so that caused huge problems for the already fragile economy. And then there was this devastating cyclone in the end of 1942. So all these causes, and then there is the question of Winston Churchill.
And one of the reasons sometimes this issue is not addressed is the huge controversy. On the one hand, some people suggesting Churchill should be regarded as a war criminal. On the other, people saying it's a disgraceful slur on Britain's wartime leader. Does this programme try to answer that question, or are you just hearing the voices of people?
From my perspective, it's a really valid question to ask that, but it's hugely and hotly debated. And I think it has obscured this huge number, this 3 million people. I mean, it's one of the largest losses of civilian life. And I think that's what I wanted to excavate with these eyewitness accounts and the survivor accounts that have never been recorded.
Which must have been terribly difficult to find.
It was so difficult to find because it's 80 years on. And as you know, that war generation is kind of slipping away from us before our eyes. And there are not that many people who can recount that. But there are people still living in our country like Partha. The oldest person I interviewed was 97. And she had such clarity when she remembered that time. It was very disturbing what she remembered. She remembered dead bodies, vultures on the streets of Calcutta. I watched her shudder as she recalled the smell. And you don't forget those memories 80 years on, and the survivors too. No one's asked them. Well, I found one man in Bengal who's trying to collect those testimonies. And he says when he approaches them, they burst into tears and say, "Why have you come so late?"
Kavita Puri speaking to Nick Robinson. And all episodes of 3 Million are available on BBC Sounds Now. The first episode will be broadcast this Sunday at 13:30 GMT. Now, when a black Texan boy, Darryl George, turned up for school with dreadlocks, he was punished. He took his case to court, though. But now a judge has ruled that this did not count as discrimination. In other words, schools could punish children for their dreadlocks. The decision was met with sighs and gasps by many of those gathered in the courthouse, which included Darryl, his supporters, and advocates for what they consider to be natural hair. The BBC's Brandon Drennan in Washington has been covering the story. James Reynolds asked him to describe Darryl's hairstyle.
His hair is in dreadlocks. They're tied and twisted together. The locked chunks of hair are almost braided together, sitting tightly and neatly on top of his head.
I'm seeing a picture of him outside the court, and his hair is done up. It doesn't touch the collar at all. But how does that break the rules?
So in all the photos, like you just mentioned, that I've seen, I've never seen his hair fall below his earlobes or to the shirt collar. The school district's dress code states that the student's hair cannot touch the shirt collar or reach that length, nor can it be worn in a style that would allow the hair to reach that length if it was unraveled. So even though we've never seen him in photos where his hair is longer than the limit, the fact that it could be longer than the limit if he were to let it down is in violation of the district's dress code.
What did he and his lawyers and supporters tell the court?
George and his mom both cried after the judge's ruling. He said that all of this over my hair, he's been in school suspension and out of a normal classroom setting over this since August. And so he feels his education is being compromised over something trivial and that he's being discriminated against because of a cultural hairstyle.
And in some schools across the world, kids are told to cut their hair. When he was told to cut his hair or face the prospect of not attending lessons, how do you explain the importance of not cutting his hair to the court?
He said that one of the reasons for refusing to cut his hair is because of its cultural significance. He said it's how I feel closer to my ancestors. So particularly, I think, what I've seen when it comes to African Americans and their hairstyles, regulations and policies aimed at reducing or minimizing or eliminating them make them feel othered, less welcomed. And so this just was an uncomfortable feeling, and he wanted to stand his ground against what he perceived as discrimination.
Brandon, you report from the United States. Tell us about dress codes and hair codes as they've affected people that you know.
It's not uncommon for this, a scenario similar to this to present itself. A conversation I've had even with family members who have natural hair, you know, should I cut my hair? Should I cut my dreadlocks to pursue a professional career, or will I be received as less capable because I'm going to be stereotyped in a certain way? So certainly, even if there isn't an outright policy saying you have to wear your hair a certain way, Black Americans in particular are very aware of the stereotypes that surround these natural hairstyles.
Brandon Drennan speaking to James Reynolds. A near-complete fossil that scientists describe as dragon-like has been discovered in China. The previously unidentified 5-meter-long aquatic reptile is 240 million years old and predates the dinosaurs. And it is appropriate that it's been described as dragon-like, having been unearthed in a country with a rich mythology about dragons. Stephen Speakman from Stuttgart State Museum of Natural History in Germany worked on the fossil and described it to Paul Henley.
So this animal is very remarkable because it has an extremely long neck, but also a very elongate and snake-like body, quite a long tail, and its limbs were very flipper-like, like you can see in a sea turtle today. So it was an animal that was really quite well adapted to aquatic life and with a very elongate and snake-like body overall.
It lived in the water all the time, did it?
We think so, yes. There has actually been a previous study on one of these animals that showed that it actually had an embryo in its abdominal region, suggesting that these animals even gave birth to life young rather than laying eggs, which meant they did not have to go back onto land to lay eggs.
Its name, I read, means terrible-headed reptile, which is fairly scary. It's not a dinosaur, though.
No, it's not a dinosaur. And actually, the reason why it's called terrible-headed lizard or reptile is actually a funny one, because when this animal was first described in 2003, it was described just on the basis of a single skull. But now that we know the complete animal and see its very bizarre and snake-like body, you can actually say that the skull is almost the least terrifying thing about this animal.
Now, it was unearthed in China. You've worked on this fossil, even though it's still in China. How did the access work? Is this an international thing?
Yes, this is very much an international work. I'm the first author on this, but it was very much a collaborative project with Chinese colleagues involved. So the specimens were located in the museum in Beijing and also one in Zhejiang. These colleagues from China, they invited me as well as some of my co-authors onto this project for expertise on these animals.
You mentioned there are lots of new discoveries of this kind made in China these days.
Yes, China is really, since the last 2 decades or so, really a hotspot for fossils of different time periods, including the one we're talking about today, the Triassic. It's really astounding fossils are coming out of China.
Stephen Speakman speaking to Paul Henley about the terrible-headed reptile. Eurovision is seen by some as a bit of a laugh, or at least that's the idea. But the world's biggest live music contest looks set to be immersed in political machinations once again. Protesters had already objected to Israel taking part in the wake of the conflict in Gaza. But now it's been alleged that Israel's entry refers to the Hamas attacks which triggered that conflict. This in a competition where politics is supposed to be a no-no. Our music correspondent Mark Savage reports on what looks like becoming another unwelcome sideshow to the main event in May.
This is Eden Golan, who is hoping to represent Israel at the Eurovision Song Contest in Sweden this May. She was selected after winning the TV talent show Rising Star earlier this month. At the time, she dedicated her performance to the families waiting for their loved ones to return from the war in Gaza. The lyrics for Israel's song October Rain were published earlier this week, and they appear to refer to the victims of the Hamas attacks on October the 7th last year. At the end of the song, Golan sings in Hebrew, "They were all good children, each one of them." Under Eurovision rules, countries cannot perform songs that contain political messages, and the EBU, which organises the contest, says it is currently examining Israel's lyrics. The country's culture minister, Miki Zohar, has called the scrutiny outrageous.
The song is very emotional. There's no political character. This is a song which expresses people's feelings and the sorrow we've experienced.
Eurovision organisers stress that they examine the lyrics of every song submitted to the contest. In 2009, they rejected George's entry, a satirical disco anthem called We Don't Want to Put In, for its references to the Russian President Vladimir Putin. In 2021, Belarus withdrew from the competition after two of its songs were disqualified on political grounds. But other countries have got away with political references.
When strangers are coming.
In 2016, the Ukrainian singer Jamala entered with a song that referred to Russia's forced deportation of Crimean Tatars in 1944. It was widely perceived as an allegory for Russian aggression towards modern-day Ukraine, but the EBU allowed Jamala to continue in the competition, and she ended up winning.
Mark Savage. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Gabriel O'Regan, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.
Sasha hated sand, the way it stuck to things for weeks. So when Maddie shared a surf trip on Expedia Trip Planner, he hesitated. Then he added a hotel with a cliffside pool to the plan, and they both spent the week in the water. You were made to follow your whims. We were made to help find a place on the beach with a pool and a waterfall and a soaking tub and, of course, a great shower. Expedia, made to travel.